Out of a worldwide population of 1.9 billion Muslims, 1.4 billion outright reject Islamism and the Muslim Brotherhood and Jamaat Islami. That doesn't mean that the rest accept, but the good news is, still the majority of Muslims around the world reject Islamism.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Mahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider. My co-host Asher Fredman, who is the executive director of the Misgav Institute, is not here this week. Eventually, we will record an episode together again, but not this week. So each week we bring you fresh insights into the most critical developments in Israel and the Middle East. Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We read every email that you send us and we try to respond to them. We love to hear your feedback. On this week's episode, we're going to focus on the Muslim Brotherhood with guest Haris Rafiq, the vice president of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. We're going to talk about who the Muslim Brotherhood are, what do they believe, why are they a threat to the West, and how they can be countered, how that threat can be countered. This week, President Donald Trump ordered the State Department to move towards designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist organization by identifying each of its chapters and designating them. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu thanked Trump for that effort in a recent statement and said Israel will be making a similar move. I want to briefly address that because our guest does not address the situation in Israel. In Israel, the Muslim Brotherhood has been around for arguably 100 years. Before the establishment of the State of Israel, you had the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was inspired by Muslim Brotherhood ideology, also by Nazi ideology. He collaborated with the Nazis, but he instigated and incited violent, murderous riots against the Jews living in mandatory Palestine. But after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Muslim Brotherhood was quieter for some decades. And then there were two sort of different trends with homegrown Muslim Brotherhoods. There was one that led to the creation of Hamas that was started in Gaza. But we'll talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about domestically in Israel, where the Muslim Brotherhood began first as a somewhat violent organization, just like Hamas. But after its founder went to prison for a few years in Israel, he actually started preaching nonviolence and taking up the more societal, educational, and religious sides of the Muslim Brotherhood, which again, we'll get more into what they believe with the guest. That was in the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, with the Oslo Accords, there was a split within the Israeli Muslim Brotherhood between North and South. The North opposed the Oslo Accords. They opposed sort of by accepting a two-state solution, you're accepting Israel as a Jewish state, essentially. And so they opposed that, whereas the southern branch, which sort of stuck with the original founders, they thought that that was fine. And the real split that divided North and South in Israel was ultimately when the southern branch decided to run for seats in the Knesset as the Ra'am party. So before they had only run for municipal positions to be mayors of Arab cities, city council members, etc. And so that split continues to this day between the northern branch, which is more radical and doesn't want to participate in the national political process of Israel, and the southern branch, which is the Ra'am party. Now, the northern branch was banned 10 years ago for its connections to Hamas and funding Hamas. And it's the head of the northern branch, Sheikh Raad Saleh, is, you know, incites against Israel, makes all sorts of very radical statements, has been convicted of incitement to terrorism and things like that in Israel. Whereas the southern branch continues to be a party in the Knesset, a controversial party, let's say, for many reasons. In 2021, they became the first independent Arab party to join a governing coalition in Israel. The party's leader, Mansour Abbas, decided to continue with their sort of greater pragmatism, or at least more pragmatic than the northern branch, where they said they want to focus on the domestic issues impacting Israeli Arabs, and the way to help them the most and have the greatest impact is to be part of a governing coalition. So he did something that had not been done before. But the opponents of that government, which was much of the Israeli right, continue to point out, well, actually, they come from Muslim Brotherhood ideology. Muslim Brotherhood is this huge international web that includes all kinds of, frankly, enemies of Israel. And a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood ideology is anti-Semitic. In Israel, it's called the Islamic movement, not the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's the same. So the southern branch of the Islamic movement has sort of disavowed anti-Semitism, and Mansour Abbas accepts that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. There continue to be concerns about that, and some of those concerns seem to have come to fruition because there are charities run by the southern branch of the Islamic movement that's supposed to go to Palestinian widows and orphans, and it was found that some of that money was being funneled to Hamas-affiliated charities and Hamas-affiliated people. If you want to learn more about that, I wrote an article, a recent article for JewishInsider.com about it, and you can read all the details there. But we're going to now hear more broadly about what the Muslim Brotherhood does around the Muslim world and the Western world, and what President Trump's announcement of moving to ban it really means. So our guest this week is Haris Rafiq, Vice President of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, known as ISGAP. They're a leading counter-extremism and counter-terrorism organization. Haris has advised governments and institutions, including the UK Home Office, the European Union, and the US Senate. He is the former CEO of Quilliam International, which is also a counter-extremism organization based in the UK. He brings over two decades of experience in combating Islamist extremism and anti-Semitism across Europe, North Africa, and North America. Haris Rafiq, welcome to the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast. You've been in Washington, I know, talking about ISGAP's new Muslim Brotherhood report. And just days after ISGAP did a big presentation in Washington, President Trump said he's going to try to ban the Muslim Brotherhood. So obviously it worked. So tell us a little bit about the report, the Muslim Brotherhood Strategic Entryism into the United States, a systemic analysis. So if you could give us an overview.
Sure. First of all, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast. Thank you for having me. For decades now, we've known that the Islamism has been a problem within our liberal secular democracies. And when I say Islamism, I'm saying Islamism versus Islam. There is a difference between the two. In the same way that there's a difference between social and socialism. Social happens to be the way that we perhaps interact with each other, maybe in a cafe, maybe we're hanging out, maybe we're doing something. Socialism is a distinct political ideology that happens to be left of center. Islam is a religion practiced by over 1400 years by nearly 1.9 billion people at the moment in so many different ways, and often excommunicating each other, often cursing each other for not being proper Muslims. Islamism is a contemporary political ideology that really wants two things. And this leads up to the report. And by the way, we hadn't made that name up. It's come from the Arabic Islamiyyun, in which the Muslim Brotherhood used themselves when they set up their charters to differentiate themselves from ordinary Muslims at the time. And they want two things. One is to set up a utopian Islamist state and enforce their version of Sharia-based law on the whole state, and secondly, to spread that around the world. And the third thing really is a tactic, the opium of the masses, and that's to wipe Israel off the map. So what our report is about, analyzing from documents that are authenticated as being original, the blueprint, the strategy of how the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to and has been achieving institutional entrenchment within our liberal secular democracies. It was a 100-year plan, and they're kind of 43 years into it. So we looked at the who, the why, the what, the where, and by whom, and then actually analyzed how well they're doing against it.
So could you tell us a little bit about what they are doing in the US, who, where?
Sure. I think the first thing to understand is the phases of this blueprint. And by the way, they have a name for it. It's called Tamkeen. Tamkeen is the strategy. I don't know if you speak Arabic, but it means literally, it means if you, in Arabic, if you actually try to translate a word, it doesn't quite often mean the same thing unless you look at the whole context and how it's used. So Tamkeen, if you literally translate it in the way that some people in the government, for example, on some of these documents, it means empowerment or settlement. But within the context of their document, it means to achieve institutional entrenchment through empowering themselves and their followers. So to understand really what that means, there have been, I guess, four key phases and four ideologues. The first one is Hassan al-Banna, who basically set up the framework, the foundation. He's the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. The second ideologue really is somebody called Qutb, Sayyid Qutb, and he became a lot more revolutionary. So he took what al-Banna had put together and sort of turned it into revolutionary, and he built concepts such as the vanguard, and he advocated for an ideologically pure elite to separate from what he considered a corrupt society, Jahliya. Phase three is Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who I'm sure your audience is familiar with. He recently died, but he was, I guess, over the last few decades, the most influential ideologue for the Muslim Brotherhood. And he came up with the concept of gradualism and adaption, to adapt for where you are. And then the final phase, really, the final doctrine or the ideologue, really, is a guy called Salabi, who actually became a lot more militant, neo-jihadist. So this develops over time, and it's about, first of all, figuring out a way to persuade Muslims, if you're living in the West, that the Islam that their parents practiced, the Islam that their uncles practiced, all the things that they had, is actually wrong. And it fits into bid'ah, shirk, haram, kufar. Bid'ah means innovation, shirk, false association to a deity. Haram means not allowed. And kufr means being a disbeliever. So first of all, change the Islam within that's practiced. And then secondly, outwards, latch onto non-Muslim societies and try to persuade others by using a faith-based identity politics, which aligns with what they believe, that they're the proper Muslims. And over time, the four key areas where they focused. One is actually political infiltration and legislation. The second one is controlling the narrative, the media. The third one is actually focusing in on how they can actually increase the capacity, and of course, looking at Muslims and changing from within.
So do you have some examples of how they're taking root in the United States?
Sure. One of the things that happened, by the way, they didn't invent this blueprint. There were two documents. One was a document translated as a project, which they wrote in 1982, and that was found in an Al-Qaeda finances. There was a raid by Swiss counterterrorism police, I guess, in Switzerland, and that was a general blueprint on how to achieve this. And then in the Holy Land Foundation trial, there was something called the explanatory memorandum for North America, which was take the concept and how to specifically infiltrate and use that in a North American and United States context. In there, they named a number of organizations. I will choose one. I won't choose one. What I'll do is I'll actually choose one person in particular who was part of an organization that was named. His name is Nihad Awad. In those days, CARE didn't exist. CARE is the Council for American Islamic Relations. But he was part of another organization that was named as one of the affiliates or the aligned organizations that the Muslim Brotherhood would use to push this strategy. He went on to set up CARE. Often there are moments in history when people try to create revolutionary change that people can latch onto. One of the key moments was 9/11 in the United States. It was a time when there was a lot of confusion. All of a sudden, America woke up and said, hey, we've got Muslims that live in our midst. there wasn't the faith-based identity politics. What organizations like CARE and others were able to do was latch onto people who wanted to be able to understand, who are these Muslims? Why did people want to actually fly planes into the Twin Towers and kill themselves? What's going on? And they actually were very, very quick and able to latch onto the media, to latch on to the politicians, to latch onto all of the people within civil society that were hungry to know more and become one of the main voices and control these four domains. That's one of the organizations that are named in our report. And by the way, the governor of Texas, Abbott, he actually declared the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE, specifically naming them as foreign terrorist organizations and organizations that carry out transnational crime, if you like.
So CARE presents itself as like an advocacy group for a minority, the way, I don't know, there's countless Jewish organizations that do these kinds of things. What would you say is the difference between what they're doing, which has led to them being outlawed in Texas, and what other sort of minority representation groups?
First of all, they've been able to persuade and fool people that they're actually representing Islam and Muslims, a particular Islam, which they've persuaded people that they're actually the vanguard. The same way that Qutb actually said, create a vanguard of the elite, they've been able to fool people at the time and persuade other people that they represent Muslims and Islam, and they're the correct voices within the United States. One of the differences, there are a number of differences. One of the differences that ultimately, at the end of the day, the people that set up the organization actually a part of the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist worldview, and ultimately they are trying to set up a utopian state, or rather in this case in the US, is trying to use entrenchment to change the liberal democracy from within. Other things that are that Abbott actually put on his declaration or proclamation, if you like, used evidence and research that we and others had put out there, where there are direct connections of people within CARE that have been involved as unindicted co-conspirators in the United States' largest counter-terrorism finance trial, and that was the Holy Land Foundation trial. I guess other non-Islamist organizations that represent Muslims and other minority organizations, I would hope, a lot of them don't want, have those objectives and not involved in these kind of criminal activities.
So you were saying that the Muslim Brotherhood tries to present itself as the vanguard, right, of Muslims in any country that it has a presence in. Do you have any kind of idea of how many American Muslims subscribe to that kind of ideology as opposed to a more moderate Islam?
I don't have the figures exactly for the United States, but what I do have in my brain, and I'm able to sort of pluck them out, are figures from Pew Research and one of their organizations. The reason I know is I've just written an op-ed about it recently, and I needed the data. Out of a worldwide population of 1.9 billion Muslims, 1.4 billion outright reject Islamism and the Muslim Brotherhood and Jamaat Islami. That doesn't mean that the rest accept. I'm sure that there's a large figure in there that actually don't know about it, we don't know what it is, etc., etc. But the good news is, still the majority of Muslims around the world reject Islamism. The bad news is that this is a worldwide poll. And if you go to places like, I don't know, if you go to Indonesia, for example, or if you go to Bahrain, or if you go to Saudi Arabia now, not before, but now, or if you go to the United Arab Emirates, you'll find that a lot of people there actually fit into that 1.4 billion. But the problem we have is that if you'd have asked me this question, I remember I did a talk in Jerusalem at the inaugural Countering Anti-Semitism Forum that Jerusalem has every year now. And I can't remember what year it was, but it's certainly at least circa 2009, 10, 11, somewhere around there. And I remember in my talk and in my presentation, I posed the question. And the question that I posed was, is anti-Semitism becoming the default position amongst Muslims under the age of 40 in the West? It was a question. And I think that sadly, it is now, you know, 15 years later, and to a large extent, that's the penetration that is being done by the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups, because anti-Semitism is a key tool that they use in the guise of being anti-Israel or anti-Zionism, etc., to recruit people to their worldview.
One of the elements you talked about that the Muslim Brotherhood does, part of its plan, is to try to control the narrative. I think we see that very strongly with Al Jazeera and how big Al Jazeera has become. And they're sponsored by the Qataris. And I was wondering if you could speak to the role of Al Jazeera, but also more broadly, Qatari influence in the West and spreading the Muslim Brotherhood ideology.
Sure. If you historically look at the Middle East, when the Muslim Brotherhood were first formed in Egypt, and there was an assassination of the leader at the time, and there was a big roundup to arrest them all, quite a lot of them were able to get out, and they found refuge in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And at that time, in those days, the theology within Saudi Arabia was what we call the Wahhabi theology, after Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, which was created to fight a colonial Ottoman Empire, which again was contemporary. But once they had their land, the theology was there. They needed an enemy. So they were pointing around, the Ottomans have gone. Along come these highly intelligent, well-organized members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were able to merge a highly sophisticated political ideology with a theology that was actually looking for an enemy anyway. And they formed a number of organizations. And from there, they spread the ideology around the world. Within the Middle East, that meant that in those days, Saudi Arabia was one of the biggest sponsors and funders of the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist ideology, as were, you know, UAE, as was Kuwait, as were nearly all of the countries at the time. Because they didn't just come to Europe, they actually went all across the Middle East as well. What's happened recently under the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and by the way, the last 4 years I've spent quite a bit of time in Saudi Arabia doing various work, but under his reforms, he's took a view, for his own reasons, and for the reasons for the benefit of Saudi Arabia, that Muslim Brotherhood ideologues are a threat to his country. Similarly, if you look at the UAE, MBZ, as is lovingly referred to the leader, he's taken the same view. So has Bahrain, and so have most of the Middle East. And Jordan is another one that's recently done it. Egypt has actually prescribed or the Muslim Brotherhood as well. But there's one country left. There's one country that was accused by the other Gulf countries and were the subjects of a blockade a few years ago, and that is Qatar. And Qatar, right at this moment in time, is alongside Turkey and Iran, is a different type of Islamism. It's not within Sunni traditions, and I'm happy to talk about that if you want. Qatar is the last man standing, and the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist ideology is deeply entrenched within all parts of their civil society, all the way to the top. And if you look at the current leader of Qatar, he was taught by Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who we talked about a little while ago, and he actually has referred to him as my sheikh, my guide, my teacher, my guide, kissed his hand, and this is a matter of, you can find this online. As a result of this entrenchment, again, let's go back to the report that we did, Tamkeen, because it's not just about the West and North America, it's about everywhere. They've used Tamkeen so successfully across the board, going from education, children, all the way up to civil society organizations, all the way up to the leadership. And one can say that the Muslim Brotherhood has a funding arm, which is directly the emir and the institution, the country, and the economy, and the corporation that is Qatar. And Qatar right now uses soft power, and I'll come on to Al Jazeera. In one of the reports that we did, Qatar actually, we estimate, are somewhere very close to $1 trillion. And it's in one of our reports with all the evidence and all the financial calculations that up to and very close to, or somewhere in between $500 billion to $1 trillion of soft power assets around the world. As part of that, they are the largest state donor to universities in the US. Quite a lot of the money that they've been giving has been undocumented by many, many universities, and we have a whole bunch of reports that outlines that. Qatar is the last man standing, as I said, and part of that strategy, and I talked about the narrative control and the media control, is Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera has two arms to it. One is Al Jazeera English, and the other one is Al Jazeera Arabic. And the two will often say different things. The English will actually be a lot more palatable, but still pushing the Islamist narrative. The Arabic is downright nasty. And they get away with it because what they've done is they've set up Al Jazeera as a limited or as a corporation in various countries, but they are 100% owned by the Qatari royal family. And therefore, in my view, when they operate in the United States, for example, they should be part of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. And we can talk about this a little bit if you like. If we were able to put enough pressure on Qatar and stop them from doing this, and for their own reasons realize, in the same way that Saudi Arabia has realized, in the same way that the UAE has realized, and disassociate entirely from the Muslim Brotherhood, we'd be a long way forward in trying to actually pull back a lot of the damage that's been done.
So let's get into that a little more. I mean, what kind of things do you think the West could be doing to pressure Qatar? Because I see the opposite happening. I mean, just this is one of many examples, but just last week, Anna Wintour, the biggest name in fashion, right? The longtime editor of Vogue, was in Doha in some kind of Vogue event with Sheikh Hamoza, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's just one of many, many examples about how the West seems to celebrate the Qataris despite them being against everything that, you know, these liberal Westerners stand for.
You know, sometimes, look, my family from my mother's side has been in the United Kingdom for 124 years. My mother was born in India, but her grandfather's brother, her cousins, everybody, and I was born in the UK. And to me, I actually don't know how to live anywhere that is not a liberal democracy. So, and when I say we, I'm talking about all of us in a liberal democracy, the United States, the UK, Canada. And each country is different, by the way. Each country has different levels of entrenchment. We are our own worst enemy. We actually don't make it easy to actually protect ourselves. We don't make it easy to recognize Islamism in the same way that we recognize fascism and communism and actually build up civil society coalitions to push back. But let's talk about the governments for a minute. I think that first of all, I think we need wins. We need wins against them that persuade them that, or chip away to actually hurt what they are trying to achieve. And there needs to be more of them. I'll give you one example we did. There was a report that we did on Texas A&M. And we found that there was, I can't remember the exact number, but off memory, there was maybe $1 billion plus of undocumented money that was going to them. We found all of this evidence on the Qatari website. We quickly downloaded it. We found the contracts. We found all the grants, what they were for. And we were able to produce a report that actually, A, highlighted that this was undocumented money, but some of the things were actually really, really interesting. One was that all of the research projects' intellectual property belonged to Qatar, or Qatari proxy, shall we say, the Qatar Foundation. That's another thing. When universities say they're not getting any money from Qatar, technically they're not lying because they're not getting it directly from the Qatari government. They're getting it for proxies like the Qatar Foundation, which is 100% owned by the government.
Right.
So it's a loophole. That's why when you had all these presidents sitting there saying, we don't get any money from Qatar, well, they're lying and they're not lying. But let's go back to what we found in the contracts. We found that all of the intellectual property for all of the projects belonged to Qatar through the Qatar Foundation. Number two, we found that they had access to all student information. And number three, significant percent, roughly, again, going off memory, it's in our report, 10% of the research projects had potential dual-use purpose for nuclear or weapons. So we put this out there. And the president of Texas A&M actually doubled down and said, oh, so it was a bit like a pantomime. It's behind you. Oh, no, it isn't. But it was. And we then issued a second report actually proving even further by using independent advice and taking independent analysis from experts. And lo and behold, the board of trustees at Texas A&M decided that they were pulling out of Doha in Education City. That hurt. That really hurt them. The reason I know it hurt them was we are constantly besmirched and lies told about us and targeted by the Qatari government, especially, and including the number three, I think the deputy chief of mission on Twitter at the Qatari embassy in the United States. They wouldn't do this if we were just somebody that wasn't making a difference. So that's one thing. So quick wins. And by the way, we went to Texas A&M after this decision was made. And I personally went and we trained FBI and law enforcement. And it was great to stand in the George Bush Theater and actually thank Texas A&M for this very, very principled position that they kind of had their hand forced to do. But nevertheless, they did. Another win was that Israel decided to take action in Doha. And that was a key moment, which when they realized that even though we have a defense agreement with the United States, we can't really hide. But the downside was that rather than actually use that and push home the advantage, what the US government has done is created a situation with the ceasefire in Gaza, which is kind of held together with a band-aid, but I hope it does work, and pushed out countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE, who, from documentation that I've seen, which was previous to what's being discussed now, they pushed them out of the whole picture and decided to bring Qatar in and Turkey, and it's a problem for some of the other countries. We are our own worst enemy. We need to keep the pressure up and keep getting wins. We need more people to actually expose what they're doing. And we need support from the US administration in the same way that it looks like the US administration is listening to our new reports and all the conversations we may or may not have had with them. And by the way, at the launch of our report, we had more than 50 expert scholars, people from around the world, at least five congressmen and senators. We had the ambassador for the UAE and representation from the White House. And you said at the beginning that the White House was listening to as well. I don't know if they are or they're not, but I hope they are. And we do look forward to working with them whenever they may want us to do so. We just need more support from them in terms of Qatar and not be taken in by geopolitics and the need to actually push home an advantage somewhere else.
Well, I do find it really interesting because, like, if you think of it as like a bullseye, right? Like they're like dancing around it, but not the target itself. You know, they'll ban the Muslim Brotherhood. They'll do all kinds of things to address anti-Semitism on campus when a lot of these clubs get funding, you know, Students for Justice in Palestine and things like that get funding from the Qataris. Not only are they not saying bad things about the Qataris, they've now, you know, have this security pact with the Qataris. I don't know if you want to get into those kinds of politics, but I always find it very strange.
Yeah, I'm happy to, if you like. I think after the bombing, some other things happened in the region as well. If you recall, after the bombing, there was a meeting, I think it might have been in Egypt, where Gulf countries and Pakistan, I think Indonesia may have been there as well. I think it was on the first Monday after the bombing, where they all got together, and there were certain countries that were pushing a NATO-style Gulf arrangement. Saudi Arabia played it very smart and said, nope, we're going to go off with Pakistan, and thank you very much, Pakistan, because the United States kind of don't want it anymore, and we'll have this agreement with Pakistan. Which left Qatar a little bit isolated, and they went with Turkey and Egypt, and then you've got the UAE, which is kind of a bit like, it's a UN Israel, if you like, because of the Abraham Accords, and Bahrain is kind of stuck in there. Unless, you know, if you go to a doctor, and you have a sore throat, and you say to the doctor, I have a sore throat, and the doctor might give you something to gargle, might say, hey, drop some aspirin into some hot water and gargle, and that will help you, or he might even give you some antibiotics to see if there's an infection. You may feel a little bit better after gargling. But if it's throat cancer, those antibiotics and that gargling won't really make any difference. The problem we have is that Islamism is a virus or a cancer or whatever you want to call it, which is spreading rapidly. And unless we deal with this, the root cause, and we persuade Qatar to stop funding it. If you look at this entrenchment strategy, a big part of it, in order for it to work, in the same way that you need any sort of big revolutionary civilizational, by the way, they call it a civilizational jihad, what they're trying to do. And by the way, jihad doesn't mean holy war. The Arabic for holy war is harb al-muqaddasa. Jihad can mean a number of things, ranging from a spiritual to actual fighting. They use the word jihad, but in our translation, we've said civilizational struggle, and in brackets, jihad. It needs money. If we get to a situation and a stage where this process of tamkin, this doctrine of tamkin, this strategy becomes self-sustaining from within the United States, because the Islamist, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been able to convince so many Muslims that this is the way to be Muslims. If we let it reach to that situation, then no matter what we do with Qatar, it'll just keep going. It'll be the cancer that keeps growing. But we're not there yet. We actually still can do something about it. And we need to get Qatar to stop. And by the way, don't get me started on Iran and their type of Islamism, which is completely different. Because until the revolution in Iran in the 70s, there was separation of church and state. And if you look at the Shia clerics like Sistani, for example, who I'm not taking a view on whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, that's a different topic of a different conversation. But people like Sistani, the majority of the Shia scholars, do believe in this separation of church and state, i.e. not Islamist. And Khomeini actually learned from Qutb, the ideologue for the Muslim Brotherhood, and a guy called Maududi, who was the ideologue for the Jamaat Islami in India. And Qutb also learned from Maududi, and there was a lot of cross-fertilization. And when he took over, he set up Iran's own type of Islamism. And that is why when we talk about how come the Sunnis from Hamas work with the Shia Islamists from Iran, when theologically they are diametrically opposed, the reality is that from a political perspective and the whole concept of a church and state and takfir and all these other things, they're actually very similar. And these kind of concepts have actually enabled the Islamist and Muslim Brotherhood to actually go deep within the regressive left within our civil society as well. And that's another subject you want to talk about, it, the red-green alliance. And why is it that, again, it's in Tamkin, it's in the project documents and then the memorandum. They said, that, you know, what makes me so annoyed They told us what they were going to do. They told us who's going to do it. They told us how they're going to do it. And we didn't listen. We were asleep. And part of that is actually getting into, by the way, the rights as well. And that's coming. The triple threat is actually becoming real now. Something, a concept we came up with about in my previous life when I was CEO of an organization called the Quilliam Foundation or Quilliam Institute. They told us they were going to infiltrate the left and the right and everywhere else that they can. And one of the reasons why it's easy for, well, there's many reasons. The bigotry of low expectations, there's a whole bunch of things from the left, or the regressive left, as we call it. Qutb, before he wrote Milestones, before he wrote his part of the Tumkeen strategy and the ideology within the Muslim Brotherhood, flirted heavily with Marxism. And the only thing that prevented him from being a Marxist, a communist, was that he still believed in God. He took many, many aspects of Marxist ideology, merged them with the religion that is Islam, his interpretation, brought in European anti-Semitism vis-a-vis the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and also Christian anti-Semitism, which was very prevalent within Europe. And the ideology that he came up with, many aspects of that are quite familiar to the people on the left. And by the way, also people to the right, or far right.
You know, you said something earlier that I thought was very apt, which is that people in the West are like equipped to recognize fascism, and they don't necessarily open to recognize the potential oppressiveness of Islamism on their societies. And it made me think about the paradox of tolerance, which for listeners who aren't familiar, philosopher Karl Popper basically said that you can have a society that's so tolerant that intolerant forces will take advantage of it, right, to undermine it. And he argued that those forces should be fought, right? So we see the Trump administration is now looking to declare the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization, and they're looking for all kinds of organizations that might fall under the Muslim Brotherhood umbrella to cut off their funding, which is something that you said was important. So first of all, could you tell us a little bit about how you think that could look going forward, what the Trump administration plans to do, but also if you could tell us what's been effective in other democracies to push back against this.
Sure. I'm going to maybe answer the question, the two questions, the second one first, because it actually ties in with something that you were talking about, the paradox. One of the things, and it's a major, major aspect of the strategy and the effectiveness of why in the West we haven't been able to spot Islamism in the same way as fascism, is that they've been able to push this narrative so effectively of the concepts and the word that is Islamophobia. Let me dissect that a little bit. Islam is a set of ideas. It's a set of values. It's maybe a way of life. It may be the path to the oasis, which is literally what the word Sharia means. By the way, there's no such thing as Sharia law, a state law. When we talk about law, Sharia law in English, we talk about law as the noun, Sharia as the adjective in Arabic. And by the way, if you look at the Quran and Hadith, the Arabic for law is Qanun, you won't find it. But there is Sharia, and it literally is a noun, and it means the personal path to the oasis. Okay. So when we talk about Islam, it's a set of ideas, a set of values. In a liberal democracy, no set of ideas, no set of values should be beyond critique, satire, or even parody, even if there are ideas that I personally believe in. I'm a Muslim. I believe a different interpretation from Islamism. However, no individual should be beneath dignity. Therefore, anti-Muslim hatred or bigotry is a correct term. But they've used this term. And what they've been able to persuade many, many people within civil society is by using the bigotry of low expectations, that where they might actually have a problem, progressives might have a problem with people who are homophobic or people who are, I don't know, fascism or racist in certain other ways. It's almost like the natives don't know any better. And this is the bigotry of low expectations, which the Islamists and others have driven. So first of all, they've been able to persuade. And that's why the paradox is acceptable. We tolerate the intolerant because we don't want to be seen to be intolerant. And the people who are intolerant have persuaded us that these concepts are intolerant, therefore we fall in line. So that's something that's happened. What's worked effectively in the United Kingdom at this moment in time, still for the last 12, 15 years, we've been able to work in the UK quite strongly on this. The UK government yet, and it may change with this new Labour government, don't use the word Islamophobia. The Conservative government didn't use it. And they always talk about the words anti-Muslim bigotry or hatred. Second thing is you've got to name the problem. Islamism and the Muslim Brotherhood is almost like something from Harry Potter. Like, that shall not be named. Voldemort, name the problem, define the problem, separate it from Islam, which it is, and then build these coalitions from bottom up to top down. Now let's go back to your question about President Trump. What we've seen today, and this is my analysis. It's an analysis of what I think, and not anything that they may have told me, or what I think, or Iskav, what I think would happen from that proclamation. The first thing it is, he hasn't actually banned any elements of the Muslim Brotherhood in that declaration. If you read it carefully, it actually says that he is tasking the Secretary of State to explore whether the Muslim Brotherhood in Libya. It's not Libya. The Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt meet the criteria for being designated as a foreign terrorist entity or organization. Why has he got to do that? Because the Muslim Brotherhood, in the same way that the Muslim Brotherhood aligned organizations are so diverse and so dispersed, because they'll set up a new one and then they'll set up another one for something else. The same thing is for Muslim Brotherhood around the world. And they are all set up as different entities. There is no legal entity called the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, in Canada, or the UK. And that's done deliberately and on purpose. So the first thing he's done is he's asked the Secretary of State to try and see if the Muslim Brotherhood in these three countries fit the criteria or any aspects of the law for them to be designated as an FTO or in those countries. That's a step in the right direction. What I'm hoping is that the Secretary of State, the Terrorism Department as well. I think that, if I'm not mistaken, that's headed up by Dr. Seb Gorka and his team. They will go and look for information, and perhaps they'll find some. And you know, we will try our best to find some. I mean, we have lots of stuff that we may publish on these things very, very soon. By the way, we have some more publications coming up after this report. We now are focusing on, this has laid the foundation. Now we're looking at organizations that fit this Tamkeen strategy, and we have two or three coming out fairly quickly. Once that's done, if it's done, and I hope it is, what that does is it allows the US government then to look at organizations that have some form of either financial relationship or material support in some way with these entities that have been banned. And I guarantee you that there are many organizations in the US that have done so, which opens up a whole can of worms, which doesn't mean necessarily that they may be banned or barred or dissolved, but certainly in the same way that the Ku Klux Klan, for example, isn't banned in the United States. There are other laws that actually tackle the criminal activities that they do. I suspect and hope that it'll be open season on some of these organizations, and there may well be others around the world and divisions of the Muslim Brotherhood that are looked at also.
Do you think there's potential for a national ban on CARE the way they did in Texas?
Well, first of all, what Governor Abbott did, which we applaud, by the way, doesn't actually mean anything unless he takes some action. Right now, it's a declaration. Unless he actually seizes CARES assets or makes it difficult or investigates or something like that, it's just a proclamation. I hope he's able to move on from that and actually start looking at ways in which CARE may fit into this proclamation in Texas. I think that in order to look at CARE as a national organization, we have to look at the way they're set up. They're set up as chapters. They're set up in multiple different entities around the different states. They have an umbrella body, and they have many, many different ways that they work together. Without saying too much in what may be coming in the future from some of the work that we may be doing or some of the work that other people may be doing, if there is a way, it'll be found.
All right. Harris Rafiq, thank you so much for this. This has been very interesting, and I wish you guys luck.
Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be on your for somebody to be on your podcast. I'm an avid viewer and a fan.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MidEastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we will be back next week.